Yeah, there's something I think about. It's a doc, you gotta go first class.
Hey, we're in lesson 55. A long one. These clause relationships. And trying to decide here. I'm not sure how long this is going to take us to get through. I better not assign the. We'll be having our quizzes, lesson vocab 53 to 55, the week, probably the week after break, but I'm not sure now. I better not assign these until Thursday, just to see how long it takes us to get through this chapter, because this one is rather detailed and, you know, there's a lot of material to go through. So I think we'll just kind of tentatively talk about the week after break for the vocab and the following week for the grammar, but it may be pushed off a week beyond that, depending on how long this takes. So we'll hold the final dates on those. Try to get your other quizzes, test back to you here this by the end of the week, hopefully. Then, looking at lesson 55, as you recall, we're dealing with conditional sentences, and the feature that we've noted up to this point is the fact that in some instances, we don't have a clear marking for the protasis and the apotasis of a conditional, in other words, the if clause and the then clause. And in those situations, you're pretty much dependent upon the context. And there may be some potential ambiguous situations as to whether the thing is just a narrative sequence of statements or whether it's an if-then situation. And sometimes it's difficult to decide where the if comes and the then comes, where to split it up. So that's what the first section is dealing with here. But then we have at the top of page 277, just a first indented paragraph there, conditional sentences marked by special with a special conjunction if are of two types. Number one, those introduced by im, hain, or ki, which are real, fulfilled, or fulfillable. And two, those introduced by lu, negative lu lei, which are unreal, contrary to fact, unfulfillable. We'll get to those a little bit later on. Now, dealing with the type one, those that are real, we have some other complications, and that has to do essentially with whether you're starting off with a perfect or an imperfect in your verb form. So, type number one, the protasis, the if clause, may have a perfect, imperfect, or participial predicate. It is difficult to maintain these distinctions in translation. The perfect sometimes has the value of the English perfect, or perhaps overcorrectly the future perfect, but more often takes on the value of the Hebrew imperfect in its general present future function. Thus, although one may make a valid distinction between im matsati chen, or and if I have found favor, or im emtsa chen, if I find favor, that same distinction becomes artificial if applied to, and we read this example last time, if you cross over with me, and then if they cross over with you. And in both cases, we've got a similar construction, but the first one uses a perfect verb, avarti, avarta, and the second one is avru, and that's an imperfect form. And they're translating it the same way. If you cross over with me, or if they cross over with you, they're translating both the perfect and the imperfect the same way. And I mentioned, we were on this discussion last time, where we left off. Both protases refer to future events as conditions. It is always possible to justify the use of the perfect in the protasis as representing a completed action of accomplished state in the mind of the speaker. And that's the point we were on last time. Wondering, how can you use the perfect for a conditional? And the idea is, apparently, that you may be talking about a future state, but you may be fixing your mental orientation at the point at which in the future the action has been completed, and then it becomes the cause of another action. And that's what he's worded a little bit differently here. It's representing a completed action of accomplished state in the mind of the speaker. So, for example, if we look at that first example above, about if you cross over with me, the perfect there would be, could be translated, if you have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. Well, in English, it may be a little awkward literally, but I think you can still understand it. If you have crossed over me, if at that time you have crossed over me with me, not meaning that you've done it already, but if you have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. And that "im" there is helping you to see that you can't take this "im" plus the perfect following. It isn't going to be referring to a past action, because a past action that's already completed is no longer an "if," it's already a fact. So the fact that you've got the "if" there is in effect pushing you into a place where you're looking at this thing from the standpoint of an action that has not yet taken place at the time the statement is made, but will conceivably in the mind of the speaker have taken place at the time that the apodosis, for which it is the prodosis, is projected. Okay? Who said this was a simple language? But it's interesting. The time relationships are very interesting, the way that they're projecting this thing. But you may see it both ways. You may see it both as a perfect and as the imperfect. An interesting study would be to see, compare the two situations and see what kind of perception of reality is being, you know, is there more of a certainty to the thing if it's in the perfect or not? It's kind of an interesting question. Eric?
I was just wondering if, you know, the apodosis, they are never converted.
Well, we're going to get to the apodosis next. There's a number of ways that the apodosis may be set up. So I probably better hold that. But the apodosis can be converted forms, and you can continue work plus perfect forms that are converted to imperfect. But you're essentially getting an imperfect type of an idea, regardless whether you do. In other words, you can either continue with that or a nonverbal clauses or imperatives or something like that. But it won't be continuing with converted imperfects. In other words, to get back a perfect idea, it won't be that. So that'll be pretty easy to tell. You know, you're not going to deal with that kind of a sequence.
That's the one future, right?
Yeah, right. It'll always have either the future or habitual. That's an idea. Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the context of the two passages decided here.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first one, you know, he's dealing with, he's been fled Jerusalem, and an old priest came out to go with him.
Uh-huh.
And it's almost like he's saying here, just project yourself. And imagine with me, here you are, we just crossed the river, and you're tagging along. It's like he's saying, just project yourself back with me.
Right.
And I saw a definite reason for using the perfect there, because picture it yourself.
Yeah.
You can obviously see how you...
Real graphic explanation of what the situation will be. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Another example was this, you know, where Reuben and Gad were supposed to go over with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a difference in the sense there. If that distinction holds up in many examples, you're getting something, using the perfect, there is this sense of actually putting you up there and having you look at it. You know what I mean? Just like you say. Now consider the fact that if we do this and if we've done this, what's going to happen? And that's the feeling you get. Now whether that is used consistently that way, that'd be another good topic for study. Another one of those interesting study situation. Most of the books that mention this don't, you know, just give you an example and that's it, you know. So you don't really have a real solid basis for it, but that's definitely the feeling that these two examples convey. I'm glad you looked up the context, because that does confirm it. Okay. He says then, and I think his statement is proper here, it's always possible to justify the use of the perfect in the prodosis as representing a completed action of an accomplished state in the mind of the speaker. And that's the way they're looking at it. Instead of just converting, and it may be analogous to the reason why things were converted in the first place. You know, but we talked about this before, that to continue a sequence in the future with perfects is almost as though you're projecting yourself into the future and looking at the things as having happened, and vice versa for the past tense sequences. Okay, it is difficult within Hebrew itself to predict the choice between perfect and the imperfect in the construction with the same meaning. Whatever the original distinction was, it has become obscured in Hebrew of the biblical period, so that both verbs will have in general the same range of translation values. Well, that statement can be taken, you know, he's saying you can't really see a reason why to use one or the other. I'm a little skeptical of it, but I think it may be difficult, but that may not mean it's impossible. In other words, if this kind of criteria that we've established already may be something to work from, as if using the perfect is intended to convey a more graphic, pictorial, carrying the person into the scene type of an idea, that may be in itself a justification for making the difference. But I suppose he's probably making that statement on the basis of maybe a parallel passage, a direct parallel passage in two portions or something, that one place uses the perfect, one place uses the imperfect. But here, you know, the examples he gives here aren't direct parallel passages. As Price checked the context on it, it's not. The words look pretty similar, but it's a different parallel, it's a different context. That may be enough to make the distinction right there. Only way you could ever find out for sure is to check all these instances, you know, and people just haven't done that. The grammarians haven't done that. That's a lot of work, no matter who you are. If you could read Hebrew fluently, it would be a lot of work. I mean, just as it would be a lot of work for us in English to come up with something like that.
It doesn't seem like Landon is too big on the idea of think of it in the Hebrew light, like the identity
Not,
of it saying like
that. Yeah.
Do it from the Greek aspect. He doesn't seem to be too big on that.
No, he doesn't. All the way through, he doesn't. And even Getchus doesn't seem to be. You know, in the Greek class, he doesn't really stress that. That's why I like to get something from Dana Manti and some of these other sources to try to do that. But no, I think you're really right. There's more of an emphasis on trying to find a good way to translate it in English. You know, just get it over into English and then, you know, deal with it there. That's part of the philosophy behind many of the statements that he makes. If you think that one's bad, wait till you can see the next page. That's terrible. That I think you could just expunge from your book completely. Okay, but we have to deal with some of this bias that's involved. And the point is, I think the bottom line for me is, if we're just going to try to translate, we'll push it over to English all the time, why not just take the translations and not bother taking Hebrew? You know, the reason you take Hebrew is because you want to get into the Hebrew thought patterns. And he's doing that, but he's always making these statements, you know, that just kind of water things down. Okay, the apodosis. Now, that the apodosis is the second part of your conditional clause situation. The first clause, the apodosis, is the if clause. This is the then clause, the consequential thing. And the apodosis corresponds closely to a clause in a present future sequence. Or since you're dealing with things that are now, when you're dealing with the results of a conditional, they're always going to be future, at least conceptually, either hypothetically or a real prediction of the future. And so it's appropriate then that we're going to see the kinds of modes that we've seen before for expressing future ideas in sequence. And so the apodosis corresponds closely to a clause in a present future sequence, that is either would plus the perfect converted. And so we normally can, if we set up a series and start off with an imperfect, then you can continue the series with perfects, converted perfects. So same thing would be done here. So we have an if such and such, and then such and such, this will happen. So it will be translated. In translation, you probably wouldn't have any more difficulty. Just translate the same way you would any other converted perfect. Another one is the would, which would be optional, and a non-verb plus the imperfect. Now we've got a disjunctive pattern, so we're going to use an actual imperfect verb form because we definitely want meaning that is future. And so because you use a non-verb, then remember that's your disjunctive pattern. It breaks up the converting mechanism, you might say. And so now you have to use the raw form, not a converted form. Now, of course, if this series were to continue, you might find a non-verb plus an imperfect, and then you could continue with converted perfects if you're going to make it a longer series. But usually these conditionals, more often than not, you're going to find one clause that's the apodosis and one clause with one verb, basically, that's the apodosis. And not a whole series of them. But, you know, if they were to continue in a series, you could certainly start a new sequence now with that imperfect form and set up converted perfects from then on. And then there's another way, and that is with a nonverbal clause. Participles and things like that can be seen in this sense, and we've already seen participles used this way, but just using the normal form of the conjunction plus a nonverbal clause, most likely participles. I suppose certain types of infinitive constructions might fit there too. And then imperative. Which is almost a, you know, if you're making a command for the future, or even in some of the justive type senses and so forth, oh, that this would happen, that this would happen, this would happen, you might get a situation like that. But essentially a imperative type, where you're making commands in the future. And if you want to be a man of God, then do this, then do this, then this. That'd be an example of a type of situation there. An imperative is almost always carrying you into the future. fact that you're making command of somebody, you don't make commands in the past tense, you know. You don't tell somebody to do something yesterday. Okay. Unless you want to do it for real effect or something. All right. None of these offers any special problems in translation. The following examples illustrate the more frequent combinations of the possible clause types. Okay. Well, let's take a look at these examples. We have the first one here, im v'im yashavnu po wamatnu. And if we stay here, we shall die. Okay, we have the im, which marks our apodosis, or excuse me, marks our apodosis. And we have a perfect verb form there. And then we have in the succeeding clause a converted perfect. So this is going to kind of help you see that you're dealing with a conditional, because normally you see a converted perfect in the continuation, you see an imperfect to start with. Here you're seeing a perfect start it, and then converted imperfects continuing it. That wa, the commas there is the same situation on the previous page, that wa mate that we looked at before, where he didn't make any note about this, but it's just that taking the commas in the last syllable and so forth. So it's not an unusual form of the conjunction. Normally you just see wa there, wa mafnu, but the wa is just because of the last position here. So I want to make that clear, because we don't want to think of this as being a special form of the conjunction here, because the converted perfects just use the normal form of the conjunction. It was the imperfects that had the pathak and the doubling. So here's the translation, and if we stay here, we shall die. Well, the we shall die is going to come from the fact that it's a converted perfect. So you're using it, translating in the future sense. And the first perfect here, it's going to, if the fact that they start with a perfect could be maybe translated, and if we have stayed here, we shall die. In other words, if it should come to the point where we have stayed here, we've come to the state of staying here, then we shall die. So maybe in a literal sense that way, but in English idiom, of course, we're always translating, if we stay here, we shall die. But I'd like, especially for exegetical purposes, I suppose I'm not going to make a huge point of this in translating for, you know, quizzes and that kind of thing. If you've got a perfect and you translate it, if we stay here, that'll be fine. But it should be noted, I think, at least in exegetical exercises and so forth, where you're really trying to ferret out the meaning of the thing, that the perfect was used as opposed to an imperfect. And ask yourself the question, you know, does seem to be projecting the person into the state, and is there any reason in the context for doing that and bringing that out? Exegetically, I think you should make a difference. Okay, this is the kind of thing that's going to be awful hard to explain, though, to a congregation or something, and try to make them understand that there's a difference between using a perfect and an imperfect in a prosthesis of a conditional. You know, most people just kind of check out as soon as you even say words like that. So you may just have to give them the bottom line and say that this, the way the Hebrew is set up emphasizes this point, and usually they'll be happy with that. It's kind of difficult. But make sure you're doing it right. Don't mislead them, because they're going to trust you in what you say. All right. Next example. Im lo havithu elecha v'chatati lecha. If I do not bring him back to you, the apostasis in the next page, I shall be accountable to you. I shall sin against you. I shall be accountable to you. Okay, in this one, we've got perfect again, but we've got a negation in the apodosis, and then we've got a converted perfect in the apodosis. So it's the same kind of construction, basically. This one, Havi Othu. Yeah, it's just a perfect with a suffix on it. It's a hithiel, cause to come. So this is nothing really fundamentally different about that one, except it's just a hithiel form in the first one. And we have a negation. Okay. Next example, if we forget the name of our God and extend our hands to a foreign God, will God not find us out? Okay. We start out with a perfect again. Im shakaknu, if we forget, shame, the name Eloheinu of our God. Winif Rosh, Kapenu, Leel Zar, Halo Elohim, Wayachakar, Zoth. Now, that one is continuing. What was happening here is we have a compound prothesis. And that's going to be seen by the fact that in the prothesis we start out with a perfect, and then we continue with a converted imperfect, Wanif Rosh. So you've got a first person plural, converted imperfect. Now the fact that that's a converted imperfect is showing you that that's not part of the apodosis. If it were part of the apodosis, what would the verb form be? I mean, what kind of form? Yeah, a converted perfect. A converted perfect that would give you imperfect meaning. See, this is giving you perfect meaning. You're still keeping that past tense idea. So this is a continuing a series that was started by Shachachnu. And so if we forget the name of a god and extend our hand to a foreign god, both those verbs are part of the apodosis. And then the apodosis is marked by the fact that will not God find this out? We've got halo, and we've got a disjunctive construction here, and a kind of a question being set up. And we've got the verb's not first, and we have an imperfect form. We're continuing with an imperfect form. So this would be an example of the second category there, continuing with a non-verb plus imperfect. So we've broken up the structure, we've got an imperfect form, and that's showing us that that is the apodosis. That's the area that is being set up for the future. So just from the clause relationship from the construction, we can tell where the mark, where the division ought to be in this one.
It seems to make a difference here. If you had translated the Shakak as the regular past tense, if we forgot, it seemed to make it clear.
Yes, if we forgot the name of our God and extended our hands to a foreign God, would not God find this out? You might translate the next one, would not God find this out? We can even do that in English in terms of the hypothetical. If we did this, and if we did this, you know, would not this happen? It's really not that far from English idiom in that respect. We're not saying that we did, but we're saying if we did. And again, it's in English, it's also projecting you to that point of time where had these things happened sometime in the future, if you were living at a point in time where these things had happened, which have not happened yet, then these results would be transpiring. So I don't think it's really that far if you translate in that mode. Some things where you're dealing with more of a strong action type verb might be a little bit more awkward translated that way, but the idea is still the same. Okay. Another example here. Any other questions on that example? I'm seeing the distinction there. Starting off with a perfect, continuing with a converted imperfect, continue the perfect idea to make that a compound prothesis, and then switching to a disjunctive construction with a real imperfect, not converted, in the apodosis. Now there would be another possibility if they didn't use a disjunctive construction here. They could have gone ahead and used the next verb and used that as a converted perfect rather than a converted imperfect, and that would give you the transition there and show you the distinction. I don't know if they would actually do that or not. Since you're starting one series and kind of in the middle of the series switching to the other, it's probably best to go to a disjunctive construction, at least to start it, and then maybe continue from there with converted imperfects or converted perfects if you were intending to continue the sequence or have a compound apodosis. All right. Next example, Wahaya imlo chafatzta ba wishilach ta. Okay, if you are not pleased with her, you shall send her forth. We start off with a narrative. If it shall come to pass or if it shall be, we've seen this with the temporal modifiers. If it shall be such that you are not pleased with her. And disjunctive construction again, starting the next clause. So it shall be that, if it shall be converted, you know, assuming that there was a imperfect to start the series. And if it shall come to pass that you are not pleased with her, then using a perfect form there. and then using a converted perfect form to continue the hypostasis, which is giving the future meaning. You shall send her forth. Okay? Yeah. Then, next example, Wa'im Yihyu Chata'ekim Kashanim, this is the word for double dyed or scarlet, Kashanim, Kashelag Yalvinu. All right? Even if your sins are as scarlet, they shall become as white as snow. You're most familiar with that verse. So here we're starting off, if your sins are as scarlet, using an imperfect form in the protasis, if your sins will be as scarlet, as you might say, or if your sins are as scarlet. And then you are breaking it up with a disjunctive construction and starting off with as snow and then using a normal imperfect form. As snow, they will become. Become white. This is to become white, I suppose. So they should become white as snow. Okay? That's pretty straightforward also. Most of these are not really difficult if you just... The main thing is recognizing you're dealing with a conditional, and when you have an im in there, you almost have it identified for you. So there's not too much guesswork involved here. It's just a matter of coming up with a translation and recognizing the construction. Okay, wuhaya im ish yabo usha elek, wa'am amart. And if a man comes and asks you, you shall say. All right. Again, the condition, the temporal modifier, wahaya, if it comes to be, if it shall come to pass, that a man comes and asks you, and there's using an imperfect form again, yabo, and then sha'elek, they're going to a converted perfect, and then you shall say. Going to a converted imperfect, a converted perfect again. Let's see, that Usha Elech, that form's bothering me a little bit here. If that's a converted perfect, we wouldn't be able to tell where the series began here. That might be just a... That might be a participle form with a suffix, but it should normally wouldn't take that object suffix like that. Wouldn't be an imperative either. Well, we may have to go by context in this one. I'm going to check that form. It's from Sha'al to ask. Well, imperative is the only other thing that might fit. It looks like it could be imperative and fit that suffix. But the question is, what would the meaning be then? Yeah. See, it doesn't really seem to fit the idea of the meaning. That's a possibility. Just wondering about the suffix on it. Yeah, the form takes a seri. The question is the suffix, the seri kaf, at the end. For the object suffix. Yeah, but as you see, that's one of the objects that goes on the imperfect. Let me just check here. Don't know if that one goes on the. when the infinitives or the others, they usually take noun-type suffixes. Although that's Terry, that's, well, postcontinental stressed forms take that, the perfect forms take that. It looks like a perfect form, converted perfect form then. The only thing is that Terry shouldn't be there if it was perfect unless it's really irregular, the first one in the stem. Somebody grab a analytical and see if we can track that one down. Just be the simplest because it may be a... Nothing seems to fit right here. I'd like to know because it's kind of critical to what's going to follow here as far as setting up this construction. It looks like an infinitive or an imperative, really does. It wouldn't surprise me if it ends up being imperative. The imperative would take the same type of suffix.
That particular form, it just says it, whatever that means.
Oh, okay. Look up above.
Then it says it, preterite, third person, singular masculine.
Okay, they're calling it a preterite, which means perfect. Yeah.
What's the perfect? I don't know what that preterite means. Ever seen what I'm going to say, preterite?
Yeah, preterite means past tense or perfect.
Oh.
In other words, perfect as opposed to imperfect. Do they put, I think they put future for the imperfect too, don't they? You have preterite and future. Okay, that means perfect and imperfect. Well, it's a perfect form. Okay? So it's an irregular verb to get the teri, and the teri doesn't make any sense in the under the aleph. That's what's throwing us off. Okay.
What's the form above it that said
it? Well, you just had the... had a
different suffix on it?
It had a comment on the cock instead of a shawah.
Oh. Okay, just a different suffix, yeah. All right, well, we've got a perfect form there. It does make sense when you start off with the imperfect, then you're going to continue with converted perfects. The only problem you're going to run into, though, on this kind of a sequence is that you're going to run into the old problem again of where do you put the comma. So I suppose, though, you've got some keys here in the persons. He comes and asks you. So you know from the suffix there, he's asking you, that's not you, and then you shall say. I think that's going to give you enough tip off. But the actual verb forms themselves aren't doing it for you here because you started off with an imperfect. You're continuing with converted perfects to continue that sequence. So you have a compound protasis, and then in your apodosis, you're going to a converted perfect, giving you imperfect meaning also. And it's kind of hard to tell just on the basis of the fact that they're converted perfects what's going on, where to draw the line. But I think in this one you're not going to have any trouble because of the semantics of which suffix fits on which and which makes sense. Okay, well, I'm glad we looked it up because I wanted to check that. That isn't an irregular verb then. It's kind of acting like a stative verb when you get into the forms. Okay, a clause introduced by the particles hain, ki, and asher, and you can compare back to section 70, may also be equivalent to the protasis of a conditional sentence. So it was pointed out in the previous lesson, that section 138, that im has a negative translation value as a part of an old formula. The expression im lo has thus a positive value in the same context. Now this was dealing with that oath type of situation, you know, woe be to me if this shall happen. And if you put im lo, you see, if you just put if, you're saying you're making a strong negative. If you want to say im lo, negate the negative, you get the positive back. In other words, you're making a positive affirmation when you have im lo. So here's an example. Chai ani, as I live, that gives you the first part of the oath. A lot of places don't. Im lo ka asher divartem be'oznai kain. As I live, I shall do to you unto you as you have spoken into my ears, or as you have confided in me. Okay, now you might translate this almost in a literal sense: as I live, if I shall not do to you, you know, say you've got im lo. As I live, if I shall not do to you, as and so forth. So, it's not the way to word this, I suppose, but Woe be to me and more, you know, if I shall not do to you as I have spoken, you know. In other words, if I don't do this, I've broken the oath. I'm making an oath to do this.
Yeah. Like, no,
but that?
What this actually is like an oath.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you translate it that way, that's really what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's just saying, as I live, Chai Ani is the first part of that thing, but the real idea is, if I don't do this, I'm not living, you know. In other words, as sure as the fact is that I live, I'm going to do this. And as certain as the fact is that, you know, that I'm going to continue to live, you know, I don't know how to word this. It gets really complicated.
It's kind of like the Hebrew. I know all the Old Testament, when they talk about something, a guy will say, well, God, do to me, and we're all...
Yeah, right. That's probably the best way I've found to express it, is that God, do to me and more, if this shall happen. And in this case, it's God, to do to me and more as I live, if I shall not do to you as I have spoken to my ears, which means the way he's translating, as I live, I shall do to you. In other words,
well,
making an oath to do it.
We
I know it.
English idiom, but.
Yeah. That's the problem again. English idiom doesn't do these things anymore, so he's trying to put it into an idiom that's commonly used in English. And you try to get a literal translation between the two, and you always fall apart.
It's kind of funny the way I run across certain situations at work. Mm-hmm. So I'll ask something, and I catch myself in time and say, well, it's going to be awful if I don't get this
yeah.
quote on time.
All right. You start thinking in Hebrew idiom. Yeah, right. It is. Sometimes I find myself doing that too, because in Hebrew, you know, you could express it more vividly in Hebrew. You could just say it in Hebrew, you know. It's got a far more graphic expression. English is kind of watered down. Okay, well, I think you've all got the point there. It's just real tough to find a good way to render this in English. But the idea is an oath and a strong affirmation that the greatest consequences befall me if I don't do this, you know. Okay, then we've got another example here. Moses swore, saying, the land will be an inheritance for you. And again, you know, lemor imlo ha'aretz, you know, if not, the land will be an inheritance for you. So again, it's just that part is just not including the previous part. He just says, if not the inheritance, which, you know, if not, the land will be an inheritance for you. And the statement itself wouldn't make any sense in itself. See, in Hebrew and in Greek also, when this thing is carried over, the statement can't make any sense if you take it in its raw form, because an if is going to imply some conditional situation, and you don't have the other part of the condition stated, which is automatically tipping you off that a condition is implied. And therefore, and because it was customary and so forth, there shouldn't be any problem with this. You have to do something like that, or you can't make any sense of it at all within its own structure, linguistic structure. So it's a left-off condition that's being implied here. Okay, I suppose it's really the result, the thing that's left off. If you really think of this in terms of a conditional clause, in effect, what you're saying is, if I don't do this, then I shall be judged, you know. Sometimes we word them in reverse. You know, I shall be judged if I don't do this. But that is still a conditional with the... You know, sometimes in English, we put the apodosis before the prodosis. In other words, we say, I will be of all men most miserable if I do not accept Christ. Well, if we were to put this in a logic P horseshoe Q type of thing, if I do not accept Christ would be the condition, and the result would be I shall be of all men most miserable. See what I'm saying? We oftentimes reverse that, and that's what's happened here in this oath kind of a thing. You're giving the result first and then giving the condition second. And now the result is being left off, you know, God be due to me and more, or great judgment, calamity come upon me, or something like that, if I do not do this, or if I do this, whichever way it's going to be taken. And so you're, in effect, what you have is a disjointed apodosis with no prodosis stated. A disjointed apodosis with no apodosis stated. And that's kind of what the construction is, even though it's coming in the second position. All right, gets a little complicated here. Type 2 is those contrary to fact situations. Now, all we've been saying so far is concerning the type 1, where you have an if stated with usually an im. All the examples he has use im. You could also see a hen there some, more rarely, and even a key sometimes. And so key sometimes has to be translated if, even in situations like that. But now we deal with contrary to fact conditional sentences. In other words, if it's a situation that's a hypothetical situation that is contrary to fact, and oftentimes in English we use a subjunctive for that, if there were, or if this were the case, and suggesting that it's not the case, but if it were the case. So we're setting up a situation that's contrary to fact as we know it, and then discussing the consequences. And in Hebrew, to do that, you use the particle lu, and that will set up contrary to fact situations. It'll still be translated if, but you may change your translation of the verb forms to put it into a mode that's English, an expression of this contrary fact to fact situation, which generally is your subjunctive kind of form. And the same thing happens in Greek with a subjunctive used this way. So if there were a sword in my hand, I would surely now kill you. Okay, lu yesh cherev beyadi ki ata haraktik. So if there were a sword in my hand. Now the indication is by using lu, there isn't a sword in his hand. So he's introducing a contrary to fact situation. If there were a sword in my hand. And so he's using yesh here and using the predication of existence. So if there were a sword in my hand, then, the key here can be translated perhaps then. It's you wouldn't say because or that here, because it's a conditional situation. The key is often used to mark the apodosis in situations like this. They don't give that in the book back there, I don't think, in this one.
Yeah, but I think about the use of key there. I looked it up earlier.
Yeah. I think we may have run across this in some of the translations once in a while. We're a little bit stumbled at it because he didn't really mention this. He's got key im, unless except that, but rather. So you can kind of see there's a relation connection with it, but it's by itself, it doesn't. He doesn't give this sense. This is mainly dictated by clause relationships. In other words, in Hebrew, they just have a word key, and they just use it all these different ways. But in English, we may be a little stumbled by the fact that using the same word for one thing is for another.
Just a particle.
Yeah.
Wide variety of functions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's really not much else you could do with it to try to bring it over to English idiom anyway. So in this way, you can just not even translate it, but you should put a comma there. Okay. So the construction here would be first one is just using lu plus a predicator of existence and then a perfect form following that. Okay. You might even be able to translate not by now I would have killed you, something like that even. By now I would have killed you. If there was a sword in my hand, I would have already killed you by now. But the ata tells you that it sets the time sense for this thing. Okay. Well, let's see, haraktika.
Yeah. Huh?
Oh, really? Okay, that's the context. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? If there were a sword in my hand, yeah. That's probably coming from the heart, then.
Just after the
token. Mm-hmm. Incredible. The Lord's got a definite sense of humor sometimes, you know, to choose that mode to express himself. That whole story is so amazing in many respects. Okay, another example, if they were wise, they would understand this. Again, the implication is that they're not wise, because you're using lu here and expressing contrary to fact situation. Okay, so lu hachamo yashki lu zot. If they were wise, they would understand. So, in this instance, you start off with a contrary fact, lu, use a perfect form. If they were wise, and even in English we use past tense in situations like this, the past tense subjunctive idea. And then using the imperfect to follow, yashki lu. Okay. If you had let them live, I would not kill you. Same, I think most of these are pretty much along the same lines. Maybe not worth going through them all here. Maybe I'll just go through the English here, maybe point out a few things if need be. If the Lord had wanted to kill us, he would not have received an offering from us. Again, contrary to fact, situation, Lu being introducing the whole thing, and chafetz, if the Lord had wanted to kill us, cause us to die. And there are lots of words to kill. This one is a hifil from death, you know, to cause to die. And then he uses lo in the apodosis. You've got a setting up a structure with a it's disjointed, of course, because you're starting with lo, a disjunctive. But then you're using a normal perfect here, because he's talking, he would not have received an offering from us. That is talking about something that did actually already happen. And so when you're dealing with these contrary to fact situations, you may see perfects in the apodosis also. Because, when you're dealing with real potential situations, the apodosis will always have either an imperfect or some kind of a future sense to it, because it hasn't happened yet. But when you're dealing with contrary to fact situations, then you may be... Part of the reason to use contrary to fact situations is to show that a certain result happened. And if a certain supposed condition had existed, that result didn't happen, which in effect is saying that certain supposed situation didn't exist or didn't happen. What they're trying to say by this statement, if the Lord had wanted to kill us, he would not have received an offering from us. The conclusion is the Lord did not want to kill us, because he did receive an offering from us. And so sometimes you're using that the fact of history that you know as a... proof, in effect, that the supposed condition that you were afraid of does not hold. So you're using a perfect form, actually, even in the apodosis here, but it's because of it's a contrary fact situation. Okay, then the last example here on this page, if the God of my father had not been on my side, you would have sent me away empty. Okay, again, if the God of my father had not been on my side, starting with lulei in this case, because it's had not been. So you've got a negation of that. And Lule Elohe Avi, God of my father, Hayah Li, had not been, Hayah, perfect verb form, been to me or by my side. Ki Atha, there's the key marking the apodosis now. You would have sent me away. Well, excuse me, then you would have sent me away to empty. That's an emphatic pronoun for you. Got to watch those Atahs. The same form could be two different things depending on context. Okay, and then a perfect form at the end of this one too, because it's a contrary to fact situation and something about relating to something that already occurred. From the top of the next page, the particle lu may also be used in the sense would that without a following apodosis. So sometimes you may not even express an apodosis, if this then this. Sometimes the apodosis will be just left off, and so you may be translating it, would that we had been content to dwell on the other side of Jordan here. And you just got you've got an apodosis, but no apodosis. So it starts off looking as though you've got a structure that's being set up to say, if we had been content to dwell on the other side of the Jordan, then such and such. But there is no then such and such. And so it's translating it, would that we had been willing, we had been content to dwell on the other side of Jordan. And it's still expressing contrary to fact situation. See, we weren't content. And he's saying, would that we have been content? And the idea is that had we been content, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. And so the implied apodosis is, you know, we're in a mess. So there's a problem, there's trouble. Yes?
This is from Joshua, where he lay before the temple, mm-hmm. before the tabernacle, when they have been defeated by the Ai.
Yes. Yeah, it's probably the same kind of construction that's used in with some of the murmuring in the wilderness. Would that we had died in Egypt, you know, that type of thing. Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, first spell. We've got 5 minutes here. That's probably about all this next part is worth. This next paragraph you can maybe just eliminate. We'll continue, you know, with part A down here, but I'll read it for you just for your to see. Just it shows you something about his view. That's been seen all the way through, but here he comes out and says it. The syntax of biblical Hebrew presents difficult and often insoluble problems. Given the unknown numbers of sources, writers, and editors that have had a hand in the formation of the text, now that's the documentary hypothesis, you see, the JEPD and so forth, all the ones that had, you know, editors, redactors, sources, and so forth, together with the grammatical schools of the later traditionalists, we can never be sure how much reliance, grammatically speaking, we may place in the textus receptus, and consequently how refined our analysis can be before becoming meaningless. The narrative sequences presented in this grammar are a good case in point. To maintain that these are the sole devices pertinent to the syntax of what clauses would be false in the face of many obvious exceptions. But because most sequences can be reduced to these patterns, there is certainly some value in regarding them as standard. The evolution of Hebrew toward post-biblical type replaced most of the older converting sequences by similar non-converting ones. Thus, a formal tendency directly opposed to an earlier one must have been at work in the latest redactions of the text before it achieved its fixed form. Certainly, some of the inconsistencies in verbal usage and clause syntax are to be attributed to this influence. So now, his major point, the point that there are some differences in the way that the Hebrew uses things earlier and later, that's probably well taken. I mean, those are pretty easy to establish. But his problem is saying that in the earlier, what he's really getting at is, in the later Hebrew, we can see more of a streamlining of some of these things and some changes. You can see that in any language. In the earlier Hebrew, it was more of this archaic stuff. But he's saying that what much of the Hebrew we have is a mix of earlier and later, because they had later redactions and stuck things into the earlier portion of the text according to the Hebrew that was developed later on. And he's saying that's why we've got some contradictions and so forth. Well, it might be just as easy to conclude that what we're really seeing in those earlier times is a transitional period where they're starting to use things and get more flexible, perhaps, and that transitional element has consummated later on. There's no reason to conclude this at all. Or another thing, too, is that he just may be regarding it that way because of the way they want to translate certain passages. They don't. Their theology is saying this is the way we ought to translate this, and so we will explain this by saying that this is a later redaction and that this is a later use of the Hebrew construction and so forth that's plugged back into an earlier form. In other words, I'm saying most of this isn't worth the paper it's printed on, you know, this kind of an explanation for the situation. And it's based on this liberal... It's amazing how common that JEPD theory shows up in a lot of this, especially the reference works that you find, the ones that are dealing with the languages and so forth. Gesenius, of course, is a liberal, and he's got the same kind of bent to it. Tregelles, it's nice to have his notes, you know, in there also to refute a lot of that stuff. So this is his explanation as to why you can't always nail these things down concretely. Now, we may agree that we can't always nail things down, but the reason why we can't always nail things down may be completely different. And it may be that we could nail things down if we got our heads straight and were honest with it rather than trying to talk about all these redactors and so forth. Yes, Price?
I was just wondering, the writing of the Hebrew, you know, maybe starts with Job or Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Malachi, those guys.
Right.
You would expect over that longer period,
mm-hmm.
and plus the captivity, that the language would change.
Oh, yes, we definitely would. We definitely would. So I don't have any debate at all, you know, question at all about some changes, especially in things like clause relationships and so forth. But the inference that that much of this later change was projected back into the earlier writings by the redactors, that's the problem that he's saying. In other words, he's saying that we run across things in the earlier portions that we don't understand necessarily. And so what he's saying is this is probably a redaction that was later written in and changed and amended the original text that was there in the original Hebrew by the later Hebrew later on by the redactors and priests and others that were changing the text. And that's the reason why it doesn't seem to be so consistent. And I'm saying that reasoning is fallacious. It's making assumptions about the evolution of the text and so forth. If you can throw that assumption out and still just take the text for what it's worth and come up with a different explanation as to why the differences might be there.
And another problem, the later books we have, they're all prophetical. Mm-hmm. The earlier books are all narrative.
I know it. Exactly.
There's a comparison you can do there.
Right. There's a fundamental difference in the tenor and the direction that the scriptures are directed to. And, of course, you have post-captivity. You're going to have lots of changes anyway just as a result of that. But that's something that we always need to keep in mind as far as... changes in the language as you progress. Many times when things are attributed to changes in the language, they may be simply due to changes in style due to the different kind of writing that you're doing. And every one of us knows that your own personal writing style varies considerably depending on what kind of thing you're writing. And you write considerably different when you're writing an apology letter to the IRS or something and when you're writing a letter to your sweetheart or something. It's a completely different style. And you've got a different motive, a different intent, different type of language, different kinds of things, or you're writing commands to, you know, to you might be a military officer writing commands to someone in far field or something, and you're just loaded with imperatives, whereas another, you're loaded with other types. You may be, if you're speculating philosophically on some potential situation, you may be loaded with subjunctive verb forms, and so the style is going to be variable depending on the situation. So I just wanted to give a little qualification of that. We'll tomorrow get into the rest of this. Now, I don't know if I'm going to... Maybe what you can do, the only assignment for this one is Solomon's Prayer. There's no little exercises. It's just going through this prayer for translation. So you can maybe start working on that. I think we'll probably get to the beginning of that, but I'm sure we won't get through the whole thing. So maybe if you start on verses 22 to 28 or something like that and have that prepared for tomorrow, we'll probably get that far. We are going to go through this illustrative passage here just to show these sequences and identify them. It's kind of a good delineation of the way these clauses are used. And we've gotten through the hardest part of this chapter now. The rest of this shouldn't be too difficult. So we'll probably get started with it tomorrow.